like in the other hours, we're going to a particular place and time around the world. And I think I'm seeing a lot of faces that have been here before, so maybe you get the picture now. And the place and the time today is India. And it's in the present day, but it also is looking back 25 years to a remarkable transformation which has taken place in one of the poorest parts of India. And a little later in the hour, I'm going to be calling some attention to this book, which has been in the bookstore, and which I'd like some of you to read from. But the real issue at the heart of the session is really the place of women in a community that is struggling, and what difference it makes when women have a chance to live, almost as simple as that, rather than almost a guarantee of dying and dying young and before their time. And I'm going to begin with a 5-minute video done by an Indian woman for the Beijing conference on women about 3 years ago. Somebody got the money together, I think in Canada, to do a something called the 5-Minute Project. And they provided funding to video producers around the world to tell a story from the life of women in their country in 5 minutes. And these videos were judged and arranged into 4 groups, sort of the 5 best, the 5 next best, etc. And this one, from India, is the very first one on the whole tape from this global project called the 5-Minute Project. And an Indian producer took up the issue of the prospects of a girl child. And she named the video, My Son. All right? So, if you wouldn't mind hitting the lights, we'll get an introduction to the theme.
This is my son.
She looks like a girl, Nanuma.
This is my son. She's right, in a way. For 10 years of my life, I was a boy. It's a long story. My mother was married when she was 17. My father was much older. Because she was tall and strapping, not quite the Indian concept of beauty, she was considered lucky to have got her husband at all. 3 months later, he left for the city and never returned. He died, and my mother found herself with child. My very right to exist became immediately suspect. A daughter is an unforgivable thing. My father's parents threw her out. Naturally. Her own father gave her a small piece of land and washed his hands of her. My mother rose to the task of bringing me up. She had little choice. She also turned me into a boy. It was a survival tactic. And it gave me privileges I would never have had as a girl. I became a confident child. But it was inevitable, I suppose, that I would eventually be discovered. Magic had already worked. I had known both privilege and opportunity, and I was not about to give them up. I stood my ground. Finally, they gave up. Everyone gave up. Lakshman became Lakshmi. But Lakshmi still went to school. Came first in class, got a scholarship. Lakshmi became a person. Ever since, I have walked in a man's world without fear. I'm better than a son.
Lights again, please. For those of you who came while I was running, there's a short video from India entitled My Son, about a mother who chose to raise her daughter as a boy in order that that child could go to school. And she made it until she was, what do we reckon, about 8 or 9? And then she was discovered and had to stand her ground. And as they said in the film, it was too late for them to push her back into the role of a woman because she'd already discovered what it took to become a person in that society. And introduces for us the key topic in this session. And remember, we're trying to glimpse God. And unlike other sessions in this series, which have some been pretty well influenced by severe circumstances, horrible circumstances sometimes in countries like Angola and in Palestine, where for 50 years the struggle has gone on to help a people in the name of Christ. Here we have a situation that is endemic poverty, not a humanitarian crisis that makes the news, but a kind of a grinding chronic trouble that especially affects the half of the Indian population who are female. And the issue of gender and development, gender and health, gender and life itself, is something that is front and center when you look at development in India, the future of India, the chance to live in India for the Indian people, and they're looking at it themselves. But also, if I may, in terms of the theme of this series, an incredible challenge for us if we set out to glimpse God in others. Because of the disenfranchisement of half of the people of India, and indeed half of the people of the planet on the basis of gender. Now, gender discrimination, the fate of a woman takes place in India now with the, what do they call it when you can look inside a womb and find out the sex of your baby? Yeah. With that already possible now, there are cases of abortion when it's found out that a woman, a girl child is on the way. So the discrimination can begin now even in the womb. And when the baby is born and you find out, as you saw the reaction in the film here, at the very least it's a bad omen if it's a girl. More seriously, it's a case for infanticide. and a large number of girl children don't even last past their birth because of the desire to have a son who assures your prosperity. These are ancient customs, still very well entrenched in India and in some other countries of the world. As that girl child grows, her lot in life is to live off of the food which is basically left over after the men have eaten. In a traditional poor household, the women would not eat with the men, the women would eat later, and the mother and the daughters eat the leftovers from the father and the son's table. There's no school for a girl child. Part of this trap of being a girl, of being a woman. Then you have very early on the prospect of a marriage that can already be promised at the age of 12. It can happen at 12 or 13 or 14. In this little video here, the girl was 17, I think. The mother was 17 when she was married. When you get married when you're 12, what happens when you get pregnant when you're 13? An early pregnancy and all of the complications that go with that. And then you begin the same cycle that your mother went through now that you are a mother. And what is your lot in life? What are your prospects? What is your life expectancy? And ironically so, because these women who are so much affected by these basic health concerns are the ones who are most responsible for the health of the poorest people in the nation. They're the ones who gather food, who look after the health of their own children, who are responsible for the sanitation around the house, and for the crops and the animals, and yet they don't get the income from those crops or those animals, but they do most of the work in raising them. So you have a situation that doesn't bode well for the future of half of the people of the country, deeply entrenched and heavily fortified by the effects of the caste system as well. Well, the session today is an effort to deal with the trap of gender. And as we understand the trap a little bit of gender in a country like India, then we look at the ways in which that trap is being sprung, and we look at the people who are springing it and how they're going about doing that. And I'm speaking out of the experience of Lutheran World Relief, for which I work, which has had a partnership in India that is just about one of the best things that we've ever been able to be part of. And it's mostly to the credit of the people who wrote this book, Jamked. And a little later in the session, I'd like to look at some things in it in detail. But the people who wrote the book on the back here are Raj and Maybelle Arole, I guess, is there any point in looking at it? They're two doctors who came from a Christian family in India and got to know each other in medical school, and then both applied for and got scholarships to Johns Hopkins University Medical School in Baltimore, and came over here in the late 60s to study medicine at a college like that, and could have stayed in this country probably fairly easily and been doctors and gone the route of healthcare and doctors and the way you make a career in that profession in this country. But their desire was to come and to learn here from this very famous school, but then to return to India. And they spent months trying to decide where to settle in India and try to find where they might be needed most. And they picked an area called Jamked, which is in western India, inland from Bombay, in one of the very poorest districts that they could find. And they settled down in that village, in that town of Jamked, and in the surrounding area, and began their life's work. Now, a key point of their life's work has been to, as soon as possible, share the problem of health. They're doctors, and they came there to make a difference in health. To share the problem of health and healthcare with what they call village health workers. And you've heard of these people before, right? Barefoot doctors in China. I think the term village health workers has a fair bit of currency around the world. Well, the Arole doctors are examples of pioneers in this field of making village health workers out of villagers. And the village health workers, working with them, as they looked at the situation of the villagers in India, came to the conclusion that the women, the poor women villagers, were too oppressed to even think of themselves. Too oppressed to even think of themselves. and that they were the ones with even the greatest health needs in the village. And they came to a scheme after condensing a long process here, and we'll look more in more detail at it in a minute, but they came to a scheme that said, we have farmers' clubs relating to agricultural development. How about if we would have women's clubs as well? And they thought of this for a while and eventually proposed it in one village and began to meet on a weekly or fortnightly basis with a few of the women in that area who would be willing to sit together and talk about the problems of poor women. And they called these things Women's Development Associations. There's a Hindi name for them, Mahila Vikas Mandals, which translates as Women's Development Associations. And this became a model for the process that has stimulated things like what I put on the title of this course, this session, how women are changing the world in India through that device of getting together and talking. Now, they started out to talk about health issues, the very most basic things about a woman's health, these things which are sorely neglected if you live the life that I've just outlined, if that's your fate, but also the fate and the health of your children. And they grew very quickly from talking about health to talking about social issues to talking about even wider questions like economic development. And a list of the kinds of subjects that began to be treated by these Mahila Vikas Mandals, these Women's Development Associations, is here just for reference. I said, starting with infant survival, then family planning, dowry, you know, the system where if you have a daughter, you not only have to get her married off so that she can be something, that is a wife, but you have to pay the family into which she will marry. And it's a question how much you'll have to pay them. And they obviously want as much as possible. And if it isn't enough, they may wound or injure or even kill your daughter in retaliation if your dowry isn't enough. So an incredible system of bondage, really, for women that has huge implications for the economic system in which they live. Domestic violence. You want to talk about a global problem. We're not pointing the finger at India here. But in our work in 50 countries, domestic violence is on the agenda every time you get far enough into the work to actually have women in a position to speak for themselves and tell you what's bothering them in their life and what they need to be liberated from. The caste system, unique perhaps to India, but especially important for this kind of story today. Corruption affects them too, what government doesn't work. Alcoholism, property rights, access to government services, how to take care of animals, and things like credit if you want to go into business. Now, as these Women's Health Development Associations, these Mahila Vikas Mandals began to meet and moved into some of these heavier topics, the Arolis, who had come there as doctors, started finding themselves looking for experts to talk about property rights, or to talk about the caste system, or to talk about government services. And they would bring in people to talk to these poor and largely non-literate women to speak about these issues and start to get their worldview looking at those things and seeing what they could do about them. And in a period of time, these meetings grew from 50 people to 2,000 people meeting in these village women's development associations. That dealt with a whole range of things from infant survival all the way up to property rights, government services, and things like that. And Dr. Arolli, when I met him and he was telling me about this system, said that one of the most amazing indicators for him about the difference this made in their life was that at the end of several years of this kind of discussion, they asked the women in the group, because this is a Hindu society and you have reincarnation, right? And they asked the women in the group, what would you like to come back as in your next life? And 70% said they'd like to come back as a woman. I think the natural order of things in that system would be that you'd like to come back as a man. You know, one more rung up the ladder. But 70% were able to say, in honesty, after the impact of this system of mobilization at the grassroots, that they'd like to come back as a woman. Well, to put a little bit of a face on this, and with that introduction, what I'd like to show you now is a video from the MacNeil Era News Hour. It was still MacNeil Era in those days. When, with the help of KTCA, anybody here from Minneapolis? Any Minnesotans? You know Channel 2, the PBS station in Minnesota. They went to India to film the work of the Arole doctors, Raj and Maybelle Arole, these Lutheran World Relief partners that I'm talking about today, and did a segment on the News Hour, which was broadcast in 1994. And I'd like to play that for you. It's about 10 minutes long. As a visit, the kind of visit we've been having in this series, to the Jamshed region of India. Can we hit the lights again?
Between empowering women and public health. A recent study conducted in India concluded there was such a connection. Reza Sam Lazaro of public station KTCA, Minneapolis, St. Paul, reports from a village in India.
Contrary to the stereotypical pictures of overcrowded cities, 80% of India's 850 million people live in the vast countryside, as do most of its economic and social problems. The lifestyle here is one of subsistence. There is little leisure time for anyone, especially people in the lower rungs of India's age-old caste system. It's a social segregation that has virtually enslaved people in occupations involving any manual labor. And life is that much harder for women. All this hard work doesn't even earn the typical rural family the assurance of food year-round. In many cases, laborers work their entire lives to pay off loans from the owners of land they work, loans that have typically been used for a marriage or a dowry. The consequences of this impoverishment are disastrous for public health: high infant and maternal mortality, severe malnutrition, and epidemics of diarrheal disease and measles, among others. It was into such conditions that Dr. Mabel Arole arrived 24 years ago to set up practice with her husband, Rajnikant. They settled in the remote western Indian town of Jamshed.
Our criteria were to go to the area which was very backward, very poor, and where there were no other facilities. And so we found Jamshed as ideal for that.
Not the typical move for a pair of physicians whose alternative could have been a lucrative career in American medicine. But the Aroles were brimming with ideas to improve rural health, ideas they developed while at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health.
When we first came, they murmured among themselves, who are these doctors? Possibly they couldn't make it in the USA, that's why they have returned. They couldn't make it in Bombay, they couldn't make it in the big city. And so they have come to us.
So the first task for the Aroles was to establish credibility as doctors. They did this by offering the usual clinical and curative services, which were later expanded to a full hospital. Then slowly they launched into a much larger public health game plan to improve nutrition, water quality, and personal hygiene and health practices.
As you know, this is a male-dominated society, and when we went into the villages, we were mainly talking with the men's groups. But most of the problems, health problems, are related to women, to mothers, and it is mothers who take care of the children, and it is women who ultimately are in charge of nutrition. They are the ones who use water. And it became quite evident that unless the knowledge reached the mothers, the women in the villages, not much change would take place.
Thus was born the idea of village health workers. Women from surrounding villages were trained in nursing and midwifery. For a group with virtually no formal schooling, it was a common sense curriculum in basic prenatal care, hygiene, and nutrition for mothers and children. It was also a way to track immunizations and general health. Knowledge health workers like Yamunabai took back to their villages. The results are readily evident in the faces of healthy children. In this village, people told us they used to bury about 12 infants and children each year. They haven't witnessed a child's death in 5 years. The junkyard area's infant mortality rate has been more than halved in the past 20 years. When the project began, about 5% of children were vaccinated against common diseases. That figure is closer to 80% today. Public health gains aside, what astonishes many here about the village health workers is who they are. From the outset, the Aroles sought people from lower castes, especially the so-called outcasts or untouchables, people who traditionally weren't even allowed to enter village walls. Today, that seems a distant memory in villages like Goregaon.
This level belongs to the village wall which separated the village from the Haijins, the untouchables. So now that the wall has been broken down, the village people decided to use the rubble to build a school. So they have used the stones for the foundation and the plank.
How long ago was the wall broken down? Is this the last of it?
This is the last part. It started being broken down about 12 to 15 years ago.
The transformation did not come overnight, and Dr. Aroli says it took some forced interaction. For example, during a severe drought in the 70s, feeding programs were held in the so-called untouchable area of villages, as were outpatient clinics. Wells were also dug here, forcing people of higher castes who needed water or health care to come to get it. Then inevitably there were incidents, like one in this village where an anemic high caste woman received blood from a harijan or outcast man.
And of course the woman survived. Then our village health worker took that example and said, with the blood of a harijan can be mixed with a high caste and actually give life to a high caste person. Why are we practicing this discrimination?
There's other evidence of the long way villages like this one have come. Turns out its recently elected mayor, Mr. Sitaram Gawale, belongs to the so-called untouchable caste. Mr. Shahaji Pato, a man from the ruling landowner caste, also confessed to some early apprehension about the social changes. But he says in time he became close. The changes were both socially desirable and in his economic interest. As for the village health workers, these men say they're just as important as doctors.
We actually like the village health workers better than doctors, because doctors treat you after you have fallen sick. But in giving knowledge to people about diseases that come from unclean water or the environment, in teaching people how to prevent disease, a person who is able to prevent disease is far better.
In the beginning, the husband was suspicious. I think they were more suspicious of what this woman is doing. You know, it was more like is he getting in trouble with some men, that kind of a thing. But as the time went by, and these men realized that their knowledge is bringing more money than what they are used to, then they encouraged them. Also, the status of these women in the village gradually went up. So they saved so many children. They delivered so many women.
In fact, financial stability has a huge impact on maternal and child health. For the junkyard program helps women launch businesses, selling dangles, a few chickens for an egg business, or a small store, for example. Things that allow women to stay close to their children, especially nursing infants. It's that kind of help that allows Suman Darulkar to take time off from the fields to see to the health needs of her baby boy and three older daughters. Under a government land distribution program, she was able to obtain a plot of her own, on which she grows sunflowers. Her husband, with his family, meanwhile, opened a small store in Goregaon. Things are considerably better for my children, she says. They have good clothes, food, and many other things, things she herself barely had as a child. And even though her lifestyle to an outsider still seems incredibly arduous, women like Suman Darulkar are optimistic about the future, for perhaps the first time in history around here. Although she had more children than planned in order to have a son, Mrs. Darulkar has high hopes for her daughters, who have traditionally been viewed as financial liabilities in India.
My daughters need to be educated so they don't have the same problems that I did. I did not have any schooling at all. My oldest daughter is in the fifth grade, and I'm going to see that she goes much farther, even gets a vocation.
Although boys still predominate, girls are sent to school in far greater numbers than before. Even more significant in the larger context is the total number of children in the village.
Because mothers are assured that the children born have a fair chance of living and reaching adulthood, women are prepared to curtail their families after they get one son. And so we are seeing there is a visible change in the number of children that we see in the villages. In the birth rate. The birth rate is now 20 per thousand, as against 40 per thousand.
It's the kind of progress that years of government family planning programs haven't come close to matching. Yet the Aroli's approach has been almost startling in its simplicity.
That's why they say you invent a simple mousetrap and the whole world will come to you. This is what it is, it's just a simple mousetrap.
Indeed, dozens of similar projects have been launched elsewhere in India, and scholars, public health, and social workers have come here from no fewer than 95 countries to study the success of the Arolis.
Questions or things that weren't clear? Comments? Rob, could you hit the button on the back of the machine here?
It's real good to be talking some good news in the room.
Yeah, it's been a room of tough news. Yeah.
If a family's had a son first and then has daughters, is it any better or not really?
No.
No.
If things haven't changed.
Yeah.
You heard him say, girls are a financial liability because right. You got to pay a dowry on them.
So yeah. I'm hearing that they are willing to use birth control or sterilization or something
right.
after they have that son.
Right. Yeah.
Is there some small percentage of that population that lives a whole different lifestyle from this?
Yeah.
We used to live in Santa Barbara, California, and had Indian friends that spoke of many riches and
right.
servants and were having a hard time taking care of themselves
yeah.
in our world without servants and without
right.
just that.
They may have been Brahmins, you know, the top.
Yeah,
top
I just wonder, is that like 2% of the population?
I don't know the figures, but they wouldn't even hardly be any in a place like Jamkin.
Mm-hmm.
That one man was.
The population would not even exist in that.
No, it's too poor. Maybe one guy comes yeah. sometimes who owns a bunch of land.
Mm-hmm.
But he has enormous wealth in India, just as poorly distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Stan.
What was the incentive to keep the birth rate down? I didn't exactly follow that.
The kids didn't die anymore.
Yeah, good help.
But does that lead to the family decision to have fewer children?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Two things do that. One is if you can guarantee the kids will survive, they won't need to have as many to make a few survive. The second thing, the greatest influence of that statistic is education for women. If women get educated, the birth rate drops. That's the best form of birth control in the world.
Is there some magic formula about that? Why does that work?
Well, because they can organize, they can talk to each other, they can speak for themselves. They can decide for themselves. They can think for themselves.
Their choices.
They can make, you know, put their choice on the table next to the man's choice. But it's the single biggest indicator for health and improvement in a community is educating the women. The single best thing you can do. There's a couple, all kinds of neat stories in this book, and a couple of them I'd like to share with you. First one took place in Washington, D.C., where one of these village health workers was actually addressing a World Health Congress in a huge hall full of prominent people from World Health Organization and the American government and international agencies. And she was describing primary health care like this. And then at the end, she said what a privilege it was to be there, that she had never seen chandeliers like that, and she'd come thousands of miles to see these things of beauty and of exquisite manufacture. And she said, doctors are a little bit like those chandeliers. They're beautiful, they're exquisite, but they're also very expensive and very inaccessible. And then she pulled out two oil lamps, two wick oil lamps, and she lit one. And she said, I, as a village health worker, I like this oil lamp. Not only am I cheap and accessible to all, but, and she took one lamp and she lit the second lamp, my light can be transferred to others. And health workers like me can spread the light of good health around the globe. And she's speaking from a country where that is proving to be true. The second story is one of these, I have trouble with the name, Mahila Vikas Mandals, the Women's Development Associations, in a village, organized and working well. And in that village, a man got drunk, and he came home, and his wife didn't have supper for him, and he beat her up. And she screamed so loud that the women of the village heard the screams, and they came as a group, and they grabbed the husband, and they hustled him off into a back room and locked him up. And they only let him out when he apologized and promised not to drink anymore. And one of the women speaking about their power to do that in a place where, you know, women just normally wouldn't be able to assert themselves in that sense of justice. One of the women who was involved said, before we were like chickens under a basket, but now somebody's lifted up the basket and the chickens can go out. So an oil lamp on one hand that can transfer its light, very simple, but can transfer its light. Chickens freed from being under a basket on the other hand. And I don't know if all this stuff sounds to you like it's from far away in another land, another part of the world, even another age, like medieval healthcare or something. But there's a wonderful connection to what we're involved in this country, in this century. What we're basically talking about is that health equals clean water, some kind of a decent diet, and sanitation. You know, that's what the village health worker can deal with. Questions of diet, cleanliness, and the simple diseases that kill people in the first 5 years. When you have bad water, you get diarrhea, and there's nurses present. You can rehydrate somebody with a simple solution of salt and sugar and water. That, I mean, anybody can mix up oral rehydration therapy to keep the body from becoming dehydrated and the infant from dying. And once you get past 5 years, you're fine, basically, you know, compared to the aggregate statistics earlier. Well, those are the things that are being changed in India today by workers like the two women I've just spoken of, the ones you've seen in the video. The connection to our country is this. I heard recently that our life expectancy has gone in this century from something like 35 or 39, somewhere in the 30s, up to where it is today, 74, 76. It's changed in this century from the late 30s, would be your life expectancy, to the mid-70s. And how did it change? It changed because our grandparents got clean water sources, sanitation, and a balanced diet. And it wiped out the infant mortality, which actually destroys the life expectancy. Of course, a lot of people long ago did live to be old, but their age was being balanced statistically by the many, many children who died young. You know? And if you look back in your family trees, you see a lot of people born who didn't live very long. That's behind that statistics, and it's only changed in this country in this century. And it's had such an impact that if this had not changed, half of us wouldn't be here. Some University of Michigan demographer analyzed the data, and if this trend had not happened in this century in this country, half of us wouldn't be here because our parents or grandparents would have died as infants, knocking out the whole family tree that issues from them. Now that's exactly the same process that's happening in India. This basic health change, thanks to the mobilization of women and putting the future of the community really in their hands, and making that kind of a difference. And life expectancy in the third world has advanced by 20 years in the last 40 years because of these kinds of changes. All those little babies that die are now growing up, not all of them, but many of them. And as they referenced here, there are villages that used to have a lot of fresh child graves. And now they don't have any more fresh child graves. They have old child graves because the children live as a result of this kind of program. And it's also worth adding that, you know, when we talk about health, this is what makes a difference to health on a massive scale. And the health system we have in this country is dedicated essentially to the last 6 months of life. Something like half of the money spent in our health care system goes to major efforts to keep people alive as they're failing. You know, heroic and high tech and all that stuff. That's fine if you can afford it, but you can make a much more broad impact by going for those basic indicators that provide for health. Now, I'd like some volunteers to do a little Bible study here. Let's call this the Bible for today. Who would like to read us some passages? I've got six copies here. I can have six volunteers. Dan? Yeah? It's in the bookstore. And these are six of the remaining seven copies. And I'm really favoring the lefty. The leftists here. Could we have someone turn
the other left
to some pages here? Maybe the first person on the left. If you have a look at page number 76, and we'll just go through some readings that explain a little bit of the approach of the Aroli doctors and the way this transformation came to pass. When they went back from Johns Hopkins, could I just say by way of introduction, they set out to set up a nice hospital somewhere in a poor district in India, and that's what was going to be their life's work. But through a series of experiences that they outline here, and the good counsel of some missionary doctors and things, they decided that to do that was like being an ambulance service at the foot of a cliff. And that if they really cared about the people they were trying to help, they should just toss the ambulance service, go up to the top of the cliff, and build a good fence. And so the whole rest of their work, from those early experiences of what they thought they would do with their Johns Hopkins medical degree, was sort of put aside. They've used it as a backup, and they used it as a calling card, but they didn't use it as the main primary thrust of their program. From 76, the very last paragraph, just read from there to the end of the chapter, two paragraphs.
In time, all around Jhankedh, people understood that we were interested in the poor. We had entered these villages through their leaders and had established credibility in the villages as good doctors. We befriended the leaders by providing the type of health care only available in the city. By the end of 1971, we ran regular weekly clinics in 25 villages. It had taken almost 18 months just to learn from people what their needs were. We had entered the area through the political leaders and gone to each village through its leaders. We had discovered that the needs of the leaders are not identical with those of the poor, and made clear to us that curative services and preventative services needed to be integrated along with other development strategies.
Okay.
Continue?
No. Is that the end?
No.
Sorry.
We had started looking for community participation in the villages, but had found that no truly representative community exists there. The lines drawn by caste, economics, and the need for power have kept such a community from forming. we would have to find ways to help people to step across those lines and begin to dissolve those lines before true participation could be achieved.
You follow that chain? They knew that health needed community participation, but they realized that the community was too divided by different fault lines of caste and economics and politics, that there wasn't a way to even have participation. And their entry as doctors led them much more in the direction of community transformation, community change as a way to health, rather than medical intervention as a way to health. The next person, page 75, if you would. Just the very top paragraph there, survival takes precedence over health.
As we gained the confidence of the people, it became more and more evident that health was not a priority for the poor at all. It was only the leaders and well-off farmers who felt the need for better health care. The majority of people were preoccupied with their very survival. Regular employment and the availability of food and water were their main concerns. They sought medical help for life-threatening illnesses and injuries. Sore eyes, scabies, episodes of diarrhea, and aches and pains were considered part of life, not worth spending money on for a doctor's visit. The majority were not interested in our village clinics or in having a hospital in the area. If they were not interested in health, how could we involve them in healthcare programs? We realized that not only would we have to integrate preventative and curative services, but we would also have to respond in some way to their serious needs for food and water. We would have to address the issue of overall development.
Okay. Food and water. The issue of overall development. Survival. Isn't that interesting? You know, poor people weren't that interested in health. They just wanted to survive. Health is a luxury. The next page would be page 83. And it's really the question of learning from the people. Who is next?
I can't read.
Okay, Susan. From health education, how relevant?
Okay. Could we ask the villagers to feed their children with milk, eggs, and lentils when they did not have money to even to buy sorghum? Sorghum bread was a staple food of the area. Could we ask them to build toilets when there was not enough drinking water all year round? It cost us, RS?
25 rupees.
25 rupees to buy kerosene and boil enough water to drink. How realistic could it be to insist on drinking boiled water? Soap was expensive, almost a day's wages, so should we insist on washing hands with soap? How then could we talk to villagers about nutrition, bathing, and washing hands? Poor people spent most of their earnings on food, and very little was left to buy other necessities like fuel, soap, and medicines. So we needed to find appropriate methods to provide health education relevant to their poverty. We began to look at inexpensive ways of maintaining health, and we needed to give relevant health education. Given the villagers' limited amount of money, we could not talk about many interventions. Is buying soap to wash hands as important as buying food to stay alive? We had to learn to make these observations and give appropriate messages. We had to learn to distinguish between scientific fact and imposing our middle-class culture and lifestyle on village people. We had to look for inexpensive alternatives, food, safe water. Soap is not the only form of detergent. The poor people used soap nut, the fruit of a tree, which gave a good lather for washing. It worked just as well as soap. Many different types of greens and lentils available in the village were highly nutritious.
Yeah.
Our experience of living in poverty helped us to appreciate villagers' day-to-day difficulties. It was almost impossible to maintain good health with such a meager income, and so we began to think that alleviation of poverty must be part of any health program.
So we'll stop there. Alleviation of poverty is part of a health program. Okay. Next one will be page 94. At the back. You were, let me just look at the spot. Three last paragraphs.
Many workers describe the Jean Paquette project as a river flowing with knowledge freely available to all. All are encouraged to share information and experience and learn from each other. Over the years, many of the team members have acquired multiple skills. This prevents boredom and also reduces the number of personnel required. Workers with qualifications for jobs in the cities do not want to go to the villages, and there is no point in sending them where they are not interested. On the other hand, local village people can be trained to provide necessary services in the villages. The principles of teamwork rather than strict hierarchy, continuous training and improvement of skills results in a free flow of communication between different members of the group. Sharing of responsibilities and involvement in the planning have contributed to the smooth working of the team. This realistic approach has helped us to keep the team members together for the last 22 years.
Wow. Any comments?
Wow.
Would you like to work in a place like that? Does your boss take a river flowing with knowledge approach to your unit or your shop or wherever it is that you work? It's a wonderful image, isn't it? What was that?
They're supposed to.
They're supposed to. Yeah. There's another quote in here that I just highlight. I'd say it around the theme of mutual respect. They mention a very devout Hindu from a high caste who thinks that the poor people are poor because they haven't made an effort to be rich. Mm-hmm. And yet, this guy respected the Aroli's concern for the poor. And he helped them build buildings. He was a contractor, he had connections in government, he could do a lot for them. He never agreed with their politics or their methodology, but he respected their approach for the poor. And I think, and they, the way they write about him, they respect him. They don't write about him with any rancor or criticism. They just say that's the way he is. But there was a common ground in him having some concern for the poor and them having the same thing, and respecting the different approach to that same goal. And I think it's also a key to their success in that system, where they were turning the tables upside down. I mean, they had a lot of reaction to deal with. But this guy hung in there for them, in a sense. Stan, would you read 254, starting on 253, second last paragraph. And this is sort of the summary of the book and their sense of what it really means to be empowered. And this, in our business, empowerment is kind of a buzzword, and I get a little sick of it because I don't think power is always a real good thing. You know, a lot of trouble comes from power. But the way it's described here is a way we can live with.
Yes, of course there have been such times.
No, some people had asked them if they've ever been discouraged. Okay, and then the answer is yes, of course. Go ahead.
Where is that?
253.
Perhaps the gifts of our own particular temperaments and the support we have had always for each other lead us to make less of these difficulties, such as seasons of drought, than others may feel. We began with a hope, a vision, that has continued to sustain us. But most importantly, we have learned over and over that empowerment is not a one-way process. It is not that one set of people provide empowerment for others who receive it. Rather, like water from a well dug in a fortunate spot, the power flows in many directions and sustains those who may set the process in motion, as well as those disempowered for such a long time. It is a dynamic process which, once set in motion, transforms us, persons, and communities. So from the beginning, we ourselves have been given power by the very processes and people involved in realizing the vision. We have firmly come to believe that through a process of recognizing and sharing the resources and potential of everyone, communities claim their right to help. Only people empowered and empowering others for the common good can find and keep the respect, cooperation, and peace so much needed in this world.
Okay, can you hear a management consultant coming in and charging $500 a day to tell you that at some corporation? It's wonderful stuff. It's not that foreign to some of the things we hear in our own discussions of how to manage a business or be a better organization. But I think the key thing is the empowerment for the common good. And he even goes on to link that to peace and justice that we all seek. In terms of glimpses of God, I think that you can see a lot of God in the Aroli doctors. You saw them on the video. You know, they're not stunning orators or anything. I mean, you just saw the way that they're just folks. When you talk to them, they don't have a shred of self-importance. And they've been doing this for 25 years in a backwater in India. And that empowerment for the common good, you know, the sharing of what it takes for all of us to be something together, the respect they have for that Hindu man and the respect he has for them, river flowing with knowledge. What you just read, Stanley, talked about a well that had the good fortune to be planted in the right place, and it gives forth a lot of water. It sounds like Psalm 1, verse 3, you know, be like a tree planted by the rivers of water. Learning from people, understanding what the real problems are, setting priorities. You know, Jesus had a strong sense of priorities, right? I mean, he didn't preach at you if you had an empty belly. He thought about lunch first, you know, that kind of thing. Survival taking precedence over health, being more humble. They're high-trained doctors, and here they are talking about, you know, let's get a well going. Let's build a school. Beginning as doctors, but turning into participants in a transformation of a community. I think those are glimpses of God in action. Other things occur to you on that line and what you saw or what we've talked about? It's not a good class because I'm giving all the answers away.
A lot of this stuff, going to remote villages and helping them dig a well, or you know, putting in some sanitation system, or building a schoolhouse, it just seems like you're trying to bail out the ocean with a teaspoon.
Right.
And what I noticed with this, at least, is they've got some sort of a cookie cutter, you call it a business approach,
right,
and maybe it could be taken elsewhere. So the value has increased a lot.
Yeah. It's being replicated. 95 countries have come, including the health minister of China, came to see them.
Have they actually begun pilot programs in those countries too?
Other countries have picked it up. I mean, they have a very simple training school in Jamkhed where people can come and do the course just like the village health workers are doing, mm-hmm. people from overseas. That's the direction they've gone now, is training. Mm-hmm. And there's another area of India where many other areas, but one in particular that I know, because we're supporting the same kind of work there now in a complete other zone where this is to be replicated. And it's going a bit faster this time because they know more about it. But the change is dramatic. When they came, I think 1% of the families in that district were using birth control, family planning of some kind. Today it's 60%. The infant mortality was 180 out of 1,000. Today it's like 20 out of 1,000, which is better than the U.S. rate, I think I'm right in saying.
Is the population growth leveling off in some of these areas
mm-hmm.
as a result?
Because of this.
That seems to be the overwhelming world problem, if you really center down. We can't build enough schools, we can't put in agricultural improvements if we keep growing.
Yeah. And the people feel it at their own level because of the lack of land and the erosion and lack of sustainable agriculture. I'd like to tell one little story in closing, but before I do that, let me do a commercial. This book was printed in India. We don't really have the right to sell it because of that, because there is a U.S. version that we would be undercutting. But I took some of the Indian printed copies and sent them to the bookstore here, and what you can pay to have it is the handling. For $3, $2.75 plus tax. For $3, if you'd like one of those copies that's out there, give me the money, keep the copy. I'll return the rest to the bookstore. But it's not a novel, it's not a gripper, it's not a romance, but it's an incredible story, I think, of God seen in these two doctors and in the many, many people they deal with, people like Lalanbhai. And let me close with the story of Lalanbhai. Lalanbhai was an outcast from you heard them talk about Harijans, the untouchables. She was married off young to a man who got her pregnant, and she had a kid, but the kid died. So the man kicked her out. She wasn't too old yet. I think she was married off at 12. Wasn't too old yet after that experience that they managed to marry her off again, but she wasn't very desirable, so they only managed to get her married to an old, sick man. The old sick man managed to have a child with her and then died himself. So now she was twice married, twice widowed, an outcast, and the only thing she could do was to look after the mayor's cattle in a shed outside of town. And here's where the Dalits live, here's where the regular people live, these are the untouchables, the oppressed ones. And the mayor had a cow shed here, and that's where Lalambai worked. And she did things like feed them and take their dung and make it into patties that you can burn and cook your food with. And that was all she was fit for. Strangely enough, though, one day, under the influence of the Aroli doctors who were working on that village in a long process, the mayor asked her to be a village health worker. She couldn't believe her eyes that anybody would have asked her to do anything. She went with great trepidation to the training course. She had never even sat down with people from other castes before. And she sat in the corner and faced the wall until she was brought in. And they reassured her that she tried for 2 months. If she didn't like it, she could quit. So she went. She found she understood it. She found she had something to learn and was able to learn it. She found that they were telling her that she had potential, and nobody had ever told her that she had any potential before. She was told that she was made in the image of God, an untouchable made in the image of God. And she began to learn and began to practice her trade and began to make a difference in the lives of her community, starting with the Dalits, but also when, as we heard in the thing, that case where a Dalit gave blood to a high caste person, the person survived, that kind of story. She crossed this wall and went into the higher caste part of the village and started to help people. And then one day, the mayor's daughter was sick and was on the point of death. They didn't know what to do, and in desperation, they had a bit of a reputation going for Lalambai, and they called for Lalambai, this former cowherd of theirs, and now village health worker. Now, normally, if her sari would have touched the mayor's family, that they would have had to wash themselves because they would be unclean. That mayor's wife used to toss her leftover food to eat off the veranda of their house. There could be no contact between them. So she comes into the house and ministers to the sick daughter of the mayor and assesses the situation with her training and understands that it's pretty simple. The person needs food and water and a little bit of care and brings her back to life. And her reputation grows. And she becomes an institution in the village. And the time comes for an election. And the word goes around that Lalambai should run for mayor. And the mayor, her former employer, and now the person in debt to her because of this saving of the daughter, got so worried that he came to the Aroli doctors and said to them, "Would you tell Lalambai not to run against me, please?" And word got to Lalambai that the mayor had said that. And she said, "Let him know that I'm already in the people's hearts. I don't have to run for mayor. As I have changed the world around me." So she continued as a village health worker. And today she talks about people in that village who know her, who she saved as children, whose children she saved, who have now grown up. And she has a place of great respect. She's been able to start an orchard and a small business, and she carries on with her training and has come a long way from the twice widowed woman who could only be a cowherd. That's a glimpse of God, too, I think. I'm running over time. Excuse me. Thank you.
I just had a question about what's the role of vaccinations and medicines in all of this? And
yeah.
I realize you just dismissed us, so it was not good time to ask the question.
No, they're important.
Like,
they're provided by this comprehensive rural health program. Mm-hmm. But it's a backup. I mean, it's part of the...
You have to prevent the sickness first, of course, but I just wondered
some of the basic
how,
things.
Yeah, how that's handled. We can talk about that.
There's, if you don't have to leave, let me tell you another 30-second story. The Aroli doctors... were putting a clinic into a village, and they had the plans, and they found a builder who happened to be a Hindu, and he went ahead and built. And they came back, you know, checked on it a couple times, going, yeah, fine. Came back at the end, it was all finished, wanted to see what he'd done. A simple village clinic. And he put a cross on the roof. And they looked at the plans, they looked at the village, they hadn't asked for a cross on the roof of this clinic. And they said, "Excuse me, it's a great building. You know, you did a fine job. Look at all this, just as we planned.
what's with the cross under it?
And the Hindu builder said, we wanted people to know why you came. So the link between our Buddha witness and the health food. Thanks for your attention and coming on this nice afternoon.